one of the guys that I interviewed was a man named Kerr. He was born back in the 1890s, so he was a surfer as a young child. By the time he was already 10 years old, he was already surfing in Waikiki. And the queen was still alive at that time. And she had a home called Hamohamo, which is right where the Pacific Beach Hotel is. And she had a pier that ran out from her home that went out into the water. And she would sit out on her pier and she would watch the surfers, which were right out in front of her. Anyway, this guy and another friend of his, she would ask for them. She would ask them to go out and surf just so she could watch surfers while she was sitting on her pier. He and his friend named the spot Queens, and that's Queens.
That's Queens Beach?
That's Queens Surf.
Oh, Queens Surf.
Queens Beach is a little further down the road. So anyway, that's Queens Surf. That's almost now, it's almost straight out from the Duke statue.
We're surrounded by water, so it's only natural that many of us play and work in the ocean. But as we're enjoying our beaches and reefs, how many of us are curious enough and persistent enough to learn the background of our favorite fishing or surfing spot? What its name means, who's responsible for naming it, and what role does it play in Hawaii's history? Next on Long Story Short, we'll meet a man who's combined a love of the ocean with an insatiable curiosity.
Long Story Short with Leslie Wilcox is Hawaii's first weekly television program produced and broadcast in high definition.
Aloha mai kakou. I'm Leslie Wilcox. Welcome to Long Story Short. When you think of a name, do you ever wonder what's behind that name? For instance, why is a place called Toes or Snipes or Gums? How about the name John Clark? A relatively simple name, only two syllables, but the simplicity of the name hides the complexity of the man. He served in the Army. He was a lifeguard at Sandy Beach, waterman, and firefighter who worked his way up to deputy chief of the Honolulu Fire Department, author of a series of nonfiction books about Hawaiian waters. Somehow it seems only natural that this complex man with a simple name is a descendant of a sea captain.
His name was William Carey Lane, and he came here in the 1850s. And in 1853, there was a smallpox epidemic that was going on in Honolulu. So he was here. He had decided to make his home in the islands. And he was asked to take some medicine to a Hawaiian couple down where the Royal Hawaiian Hotel is. So he did. He met their daughter. He married her and ended up making Hawaii his home.
But he planned to do so even before he met her and fell
yes.
in love. Was he at the end of his career, or did he just decide, heck with my career, I'm staying?
Exactly that. He decided that he didn't want to go to sea anymore. And he really loved Hawaii. He decided to make it his home. So he married her. They ended up having 12 children, six boys and six girls. And the first Clark that came to Hawaii married one of the six girls. So anyway, going back to that marriage between the sea captain and Kahoili Moku, that was her name, I'm fifth generation from that marriage.
You seem to concentrate your fascination and your passion where the sea intersects with the shoreline. the coastal areas, not the deep sea that your ancestor loved or once loved. You love that where water and land connect.
Yes, exactly right. My mother likes to say that she and my dad had me swimming even before I walked. They took me and put me in the ocean before I was even a year old. So that connection for me and the ocean and the beach has always been there from the very beginning. And that was really reinforced when I learned how to surf. I started surfing when I was 8 years old.
Who taught you, or did you learn yourself?
Oh, no, not at all. My dad was in construction here in Hawaii. And one of the guys he worked with was a man named Clarence Maki. And Clarence was an avid surfer, actually an avid surf photographer as well. So anyway, he and my dad were talking one day, and Clarence just told my dad that he'd be willing to teach me how to surf. He did, and I've been a lifelong surfer since.
What was your upbringing like? Where'd you grow up, and what was it like?
I grew up at a place called Ka'alawai, which is at which is over between Black Point and Diamond Head. It's the little community there.
Were you right on the water?
Oh, no, no. We were back up towards Diamond Head Road. But anyway, that's where really that I learned to surf in Waikiki, but that whole Diamond Head Kaalawai area was my backyard.
What was it like? I don't know that area except to walk along it. What was it known for?
Actually, Kaalawai was known for several things. As far as traditional Hawaiian resources go, it was an area known for limu, for seaweed. There's a lot of limu there, or there used to be. There used to be wawaiole, which is a thick green limu, and then a finer one that everybody calls ogo now, but we used to call it manawea, limu manawea.
Did you gather that for salads?
Yes, we did. So those two, I find them every once in a while when I go back there to surf, but not too much. But there were also octopus there. People would come spearing for octopus. And there's a seasonal fish that used to run through there, the mullet. And they would start off in Pearl Harbor in schools of thousands. And they would just start flowing around the island. And they'd run all the way down the coast, all the way around Makapu Point, and then head up the windward side.
Does that still happen?
No, not like before. We don't see those mullet runs before, but the throw net fishermen, when they would run, and it would be in the fall, when the anai, the mullet, used to run through there, the throw net fishermen would come from all over the island to throw net on the schools.
Did you go down to the beach every day?
Almost.
What was your routine before school and after school, or after school?
No, only after school.
Because a lot of folks came to school with their hair dripping wet.
Yes, no, that wasn't me. but I did surf a lot after school, and that, like I said, that was my backyard. All those spots, I surfed a lot.
What kind of boards did you surf on as you went along?
I started off on balsa, so I started surfing in 1954, and that's just when the foam boards are starting to make their appearance, mostly in California, and they're just starting to make their way to Hawaii. We don't actually get a foam surfboard factory here, which was the Velzy factory, until 1960. So those first 6 years of my life, or my surfing life anyway, from 54 to 60, I was riding a balsa board. So it was what we used to call a Malibu. It had a kick in the front, and it was just a single fin, and of course, no leashes.
And there are two of your surfboards behind you. Tell
Yes.
me about those boards. They look like they've seen a lot of action, and they've been cared for.
Yes, they are. Those are called alayas, and the alayas are traditional Hawaiian surfboards. Anyway, one of them, the one with the round nose, is made out of redwood and pine. And the other one is made out of all traditional Hawaiian wood. It's willy-willy with koa strips, stringers. So anyway, the alayas are boards that I still ride till this day, as opposed to a regular surfboard.
No fins.
No fins at all. So they like to side slip. They don't hold a line quite like a regular surfboard does.
And they're not that long.
No, they're only 5 feet two, both of them. And they're very thin, too. They're only 3/8 of an inch.
What size waves are they best on?
They'll ride anything up to, like, double overhead waves. Just got to get out there and fly.
And what's the story of how the boards were made?
Besides board surfing, besides learning how to surf on a surfboard, I've also been a pipo rider all my life. And one of the guys that I ride pipo with builds pipo boards. So when I started researching my book on traditional Hawaiian surfing, I wanted to know what it was like to ride a traditional board. So I just asked my friend, his name's Bud Shelsa, I asked Bud if he would build me an alaya board, and he did. So we started off with the one with the round nose, and then I got to know that board, and then I decided to try something a little different shape-wise, and we went with the second one, the one with the willy-willy and koa.
In the Hawaiian culture, mo'olelo, storytelling, was crucial in passing down the history of the Hawaiian Islands from generation to generation. In today's world, the mo'olelo behind many of Hawaii's beaches and landmarks would be forgotten and lost without people like John Clark.
So you were an early swimmer, an early surfer.
Yes.
But you know, those skills are different from collecting and writing about swimming and surfing and coastlines. How did that all come together?
It actually started with surfing. When I got into my teens and I started surfing around the island, when I got a driver's license and my friends did too, we started surfing all the different spots around the island of Oahu. And I actually got interested in the names of all these different spots, you know, where the names came from, what the story was, the mo'olelo behind the names. And I just started just collecting these as I went along over the years. So anyway, in 1970, when I got out of the Army, I became a lifeguard at Sandy Beach. And as I sat there on my tower, I decided that I was going to do something proactive to try and reach people in, you know, before they got in the water and got in trouble. So I started writing about Sandy Beach. I started writing about water safety. But when I read this material over, I thought it was really boring. I thought no one would be interested in it. So all this stuff that I'd gathered about surf spots and names and where the names came from, I decided to combine that information with the water safety stuff. So I just rolled it all into one and I ended up with a book.
Speaking of names, Sandy Beach, how more basic can that be? Does that have a Hawaiian name or a history that's more interesting than the words Sandy Beach?
So the area where Sandy Beach is called Wawamalu. And if you go out and look at the old highway bridge out near the entrance to the Hawaii Kai Golf Course, you can see the name Wawamalu. It's still on the bridge out there. But anyway, the name Sandy Beach actually came from the Ulua fishermen that fish at Bamboo Ridge, which is over by the blowhole. And they would fish at Bamboo Ridge, and they would just call the beach next door the Sand Beach. They'd call it Blowhole Sand Beach. That was one of their names. Anyway, Blowhole Sand Beach got edited down to Sandy Beach, and nowadays the kids just call it Sandy's. Simple.
There are so many names that make you wonder. And there are also more than one name for a place.
Yes.
So you have to figure out which is the more appropriate. And then there are probably different versions of how things came to be named the way they are.
Yes, there are. So that's something that I've done all my life, is collect all of these stories and then just kind of, you know, balance the stories one against the other and try to come up with what I think is the original version, the original mo'olelo for that place name.
How do you go about finding the mo'olelo? I mean, how do you do it? You show up at a beach, you're curious about it, and then what?
Well, because I'm a water person, I guess I can talk surf speak, or I can speak the language. And, you know, I just talk to guys or girls in the water, and I say, what do you call this spot? And, you know, what, I mean, where did the name come from? So I just pick up stories as I go. And I also go through literature. People besides me have written about surf spots and about beaches and, you know, just different places. So I gather all this material and I just kind of sift through it and come up with what I think is the legitimate story behind the name.
Do you try to find people who are living there or associated with the beach a long time ago?
Oh, yes.
You go away from the beach to find the story?
Yes, I do. In fact, that's one of the things that I've done religiously over the years is go into the communities and talk to the kupuna, the people that were born and raised there, that know the area, that know the names. And the fire department was wonderful for that, because everybody has a fireman in their family or everybody knows a fireman. Mm-hmm. So I would ask the guys at work, I'd say, oh, you know, you're from Ka'ava, do you still have family out there? Can I go talk to your grandma or your, you know, your auntie or whatever? And then you get the ripple effect. So I talked to the grandma in Ka'ava and she says, oh no, you gotta go talk to my sister in Punalu'u, or you need to go talk to my dad who's out in La'ie.
And did you know you were gonna put the information into books? Did you have that idea to begin with?
No, I never did, you know. Just going back to Sandy Beach in 1972, I never thought that I would ever put all of this information into books, into what turned out to be an entire series of books. They were just things that I was interested in. You know, I gathered the information.
And you were methodical about it. You thought back in 1972 to take down names and commit
yes.
it to paper?
Yes. I really valued the information that people gave me. And, I thought it was important to recognize them, to honor them for, you know, confiding in me and helping me with what I was after. So I did. That's something that I've done all these years, is acknowledge everyone who's contributed to my work.
Can we take some surfing sites that lots of people know, or but they may not know the origin of the names?
Sure.
For example, along Ala Moana and Waikiki, there are all kinds of surf breaks, and
there
people
are.
Know the names, but they might have forgotten the reason. Some,
sure.
Some you can tell, some not.
Sure.
Well, if you want to start at Ala Moana, first of all, you have Magic Island, and there's a spot out there that's called Bomboras. And Bombora is actually an Aboriginal word. It came from the Australian surfers who came here to Hawaii, and somebody just tagged that name for the surf spot out there. You move the next spot down, going west now, is Baby Haleiwa's. That's named because that spot breaks just like the surf spot Haleiwa on the North Shore. It's got the same right with a pocket on a shallow reef on the inside. So that's for a geographical comparison. And then you hit courts, you know, which is named for the tennis courts.
Which are right across.
Exactly right, straight in, that's your landmark. You go a little further down, you hit concessions, right out in front of the food concession. So anyway, all of the spots, you know, they all have a story. They all have some reason that they were named. And a lot of the names come from just geographical location.
There was one near where I grew up, New Valley, called Snipes. Do you know the origin of that?
Yeah, Jerry Lopez told me that story. Snipes are birds.
Oh.
And the snipes were the little seabirds that were running back and forth on the beach at low tide, just foraging for food.
There's another surf spot called Gums. What's the story there?
Okay, Gums is out on the North Shore, and Gums is at Ehukai Beach Park, right next to the pipeline. Anyway, Randy Rarick told me this story.
Who grew up in New Valley, by the way.
Who grew up in New Valley, and who surfed at Snipes, and he named Toes, too, by the way. Randy's the one that came up with that name. But anyway, getting back to Gums, Randy said that there was a surfer out there who had false teeth. And one day he got hit in the mouth by his board and he lost his false teeth. So everyone was teasing him about, you know, coming in toothless. So the spot just got tagged Gums. Which it's been ever since.
There's also Yokohama Bay, which folks on the Waianae Coast have now taken to calling by its original Hawaiian name,
yes.
Keawaula.
Keawaula, exactly right. So anyway, back when it was called Yokohama, the train, the ORNL train, used to run from Honolulu around Kaina Point to Haleiwa and actually beyond. The train actually ran up to 1947. But anyway, there was a camp out there of repairmen who were mostly Japanese workers, and their job was to repair the tracks. So Yokohama was one of the ports where a lot of the Japanese came from when they came to Hawaii. So that name just kind of got tagged with them to that particular bay, you know, Keawaula Bay.
And why was it called Keawaula? There must be a reason for that Hawaiian name.
Well, the name Keawaula is actually three words in Hawaiian. It's ke, which is the, awa is harbor, and then ula is red. So it means the red harbor. And there are squid in the Hawaiian Islands, besides octopus now, these are the true squid, and they school. And when they come into a harbor and they're schooling and they're mating, they turn red. And so it looks like the water turns red because the schools are so massive. So anyway, that's the molelo behind Keawaula. It's because of the squid schools that used to come in there seasonally.
You know, we're talking a lot about things you can see, you know, surf sites.
Yes.
But I live on the North Shore, and
oh.
I've always lived around or among surfers.
Okay.
And it appears to me that there's a whole world out there that a lot of us don't see, but it's as real as anything to those who are in the waters a lot. So many people know the underwater landscapes just as well as they do the streets of the town.
Yes. Well, You're actually making a very good point. Surf spots are ocean parks, and that's how surfers see them. So if you think of your favorite park or your favorite golf course or, you know, the tennis courts where you play tennis, to a surf spot's the same thing. That's his park, that's his area where he does his recreation, his activities. So you're right. The surfers know the ocean bottom, they know all the quirks and, you know, the currents and what happens if it's high tide and low tide, whether it's, you know, summer or winter, all of that stuff plays in, and they know their spots just as well as golfers know their golf courses.
No matter how random life is, sometimes people become who they were destined to be. In the case of John Clark, he channeled his love of surfing, his career as a firefighter, and his passion for historical research into leadership of the Hawaiian Historical Society.
I've always liked English. I've always been a very good reader, a voracious reader, actually. So I thought I would be an English major, and that's what I started off doing up at UH Manoa. But as I got into it, I realized that I really didn't want to be a teacher, which is pretty much where you have to go if you're an English major. So I switched my major to Hawaiian Studies, which was what I was personally interested in. And at that time, I was already in the fire department, so I didn't have to worry about my degree being my profession.
I see.
I already had my profession. So I got a degree in Hawaiian Studies.
How did you go all of a sudden from water to fire?
I was a lifeguard for 2 years. That was from 1970 to 1972. And my roommate at that time was a guy named Aaron Young, and Aaron was working for Hawaiian Tel. So anyway, Aaron decided that he wanted to be a fireman. And he, after he got in, he said it was a really good job, it was a good lifestyle, and he encouraged me to take the test, which I did. And one of the reasons I did is because at that time, there wasn't any upward mobility in the lifeguard service. If you were a lifeguard, you were a lifeguard pretty much for life. So there wasn't too much chance of me moving up in the ranks, getting higher pay, you know, that kind of thing. And in the fire department, it's just the opposite. They're a big organization, lots of mobility, lots of room to get promoted.
And lots of different aspects of the work.
Yes, including ocean rescues. The fire department here does ocean rescues. So that's something that I did as the years went along too.
And when you ended your career after 33 years,
oh, yes.
Deputy Fire Chief.
Yes.
Far away from the water and even fires, right? You were
yes.
in an executive role.
Yes. So the last 7.5 years of my career were as the Deputy Fire Chief of HFD. But even that was good too. During that time, I went and got a master's in public administration. And I really took that job seriously of being a public administrator of a first responder agency.
You've spent a lot of time gathering information, writing, and taking
yes.
care of the publication of books. Why do you do it? Do you make a lot of money from it?
Oh, no, it's all for love. Just real quick, the royalties are very minimal from the sales of all of my books. And the royalties that I do get, I just you know, channel them back into the research and all of the field trips that I do for the current projects that I'm working on. So there's no money in it, but I really enjoy doing it. I think that I'm capturing pieces of Hawaiian history that other people haven't. And the feedback that I get from people that read my stuff tells me that I think I'm touching some bases out there. Maybe not, you know, maybe not making a home run with everybody, but I'm touching some bases, and people seem to appreciate what I do.
You know, sometimes on a mainland trip, I go to one of these, say, LA subdivisions, you know, malls, and you don't see any distinguishing characteristics or landmarks.
Yes.
It's just paved. I think it would be really hard to live in a place like that.
That you can't relate to somehow. Yes.
What's the history? I don't know.
Right. So that's something that I've tried to do for Hawaii. So if you live in Lanikai, you know where the name came from, what it means. You know the history of the area. If you live on the North Shore, you know why Sunset Point is Sunset Point, and you know why Rock Piles is Rock Piles, and all the rest of it.
I noticed that you've been the president of the Hawaiian Historical Society
yes.
for years.
Yes, for 6 years.
Why? What do you enjoy about that?
The Hawaiian Historical Society does what I do. They preserve Hawaiian history, and that's something that I've been doing all of these years, is telling Hawaiian history through the beaches. So to me, it's a perfect fit. The Hawaiian Historical Society has a library, they have an archives. They're one of the key research centers here in the Hawaiian Islands. And I'm a part of that. I'm a part of the journal that we put out. In fact, I'm one of the editors of the Journal of Hawaiian History. So it all plays in, it all ties in, and it all works out really well for me.
Even if it's land history.
Yes, even if it's land history.
So the next time someone asks you where the name Snipes came from or why Queen Surf is called Queen Surf, pass on the mo'olelo. Then tell them that you heard it from the guy slipping down the face of the double overhead on the Alaia surfboard. For Long Story Short and PBS Hawaii, I'm Leslie Wilcox. Ahui ho kako.
For audio and written transcripts of this program and all episodes of Long Story Short with Leslie Wilcox, visit pbshawaii.org.
Is there a favorite surf site name that you've come across? It's hard, I know they're probably all like your children, but is there a favorite one?
Actually, I enjoy all of them. I like all of the names and all of the stories. But I'll tell you this real quick. The spot that I get asked most often about over any spot in the Hawaiian Islands is a spot out in Makua that's called Pray for Sex. And Pray for Sex actually comes from another surf slogan from the 60s, which was Pray for Surf. So somebody just changed one word in the slogan there, and they actually wrote it on a rock out there. So you can go out there right now and see Pray for Sex. It's still written on that rock.
And what is another name for that surf spot? Is there another name for it?
It's actually more of a little body surfing spot out there. The rock that it's written on has a Hawaiian name. It's called Pohaku Kulailai. And there's actually a little marker out there that explains that. But people still know that till this day. And every time I talk to people about surf spots, they always ask me about that one.